Okay. Welcome, everybody, to day two of West Coast Socialism 2009. All right. People didn't dance too hard last night. I'm Bruce with the Los Angeles branch, and this meeting is on Luxembourg's reform or revolution. And we'll have a presentation by Daniela Mayer from the San Francisco branch, and she's an organizer here in San Francisco and an instructor at Kenyatta College in literature and English. So we'll have a presentation. Please note down questions and thoughts that you want to share with your group. We'll have plenty of time for discussion, and we'll run the discussion as per usual, and I'll explain that a little later on. So, Daniela, take it away.
All right. The coffee is working its way into my system, so I think that, like, I'm going to start off slow, and if I start getting insanely fast later, just, you know, give me some sort of indication. Okay, reform or revolution? It's funny, while I was writing this talk, I kept writing reform and revolution, because that's the way I think about it, but I kept having to be like, no, it's actually reform or revolution, and we have to have out that, you know, debate a little bit and talk about it. And I think, you know, the thing about reading reform or revolution is that it's not in itself really sort of a complicated idea. That Luxembourg basically puts forward this idea, like, should reform or revolution be counterposed or not? And she argues why she thinks that they're separate things. But I think what the thing is about Luxembourg is that she was actually a brilliant economist, and so what she did was not only put forward a theory and say, you know, that this is what she believed, but she also, like, built the economic foundation to back that up. And that's the part that I think is really difficult to understand when you're reading Reform or Revolution. So I will attempt a little bit to clarify some of what I think are the main aspects of that economic basis. But certainly I'm not an economist, and so you might have to, like, continue to think about this and study it and hear about it from other people. So that's my disclaimer. So Reform or Revolution itself is the name of a pamphlet that was written by Polish-born Rosa Luxemburg at the end of the 19th century. The pamphlet was written in response to a growing internal struggle among Marxists that was beginning to emerge in Europe. When Luxembourg moved to Germany in 1898, she found herself not only at the heart of the center of socialist thought and home to the largest socialist party in the world, the Social Democratic Party, or the SPD, but she was also at the heart of a rising break between the left and the right of the movement. On one side were the revolutionaries, who believed that socialism can only be achieved through the self-emancipation of the working class, and on the other side were the reformists, or revisionists, who argued that capitalism had reached a point in which it was no longer necessary to actually call for revolution, but that enough reforms could be put in place, more democratic rights and more social welfare programs, that socialism would evolve actually over time. The person who gave voice to the rising current in favor of bringing socialism through a series of reforms, an idea that Luxembourg referred to as reformism, was Edward Bernstein, and he was an exiled German revolutionary. He was living in England, and he also had a close relationship with Engels and other trade union leaders at the time. Although he certainly was not the first to articulate this rising emphasis on reform that was taking hold in the SPD, he was the first to put forward a political theory and economic analysis that incorporated these ideas that had existed basically in the movement for quite a while, actually. Bernstein himself was well-respected in the socialist movement. Prior to his exile under the anti-socialist laws in Germany, he had edited an illegal socialist paper. So when he published his article, he claimed to be theorizing actually in line with Marx and Engels, but he said he was updating him for a new period in which capitalism had advanced, and it could, at this point, offer peace, prosperity, and ever-widening democracy to the working class, making the need for revolution obsolete, basically. And it is true that Germany was experiencing increased prosperity since the slump of 1973. And this had led to a higher standard of living for workers. And in addition, the strength of the trade unions and cooperatives was unprecedented. So you can sort of see where he would have gotten these ideas. Bernstein took these signs to mean that only prosperity and increasing workers' control lay in the country's future, basically. So with the repeal of the anti-socialist laws in 1890 and the entrance of the SPD into the Reichstag, the German parliament, the party became more and more moderate. And basically, both in response to the economic stability and also to appeal to the widest possible audience to gain more and more seats. I think their program was something like, you know, something about minimums and maximums that I never remember, but basically like appeal to, you know, the widest group of people and then try to like push as much reform. Ultimately what this did is force them to moderate their views and argue for reform rather than a fundamental shift of power, or i.e. social revolution. And at the time of Bernstein's article, which muddled the relationship between reform and revolution and de-emphasized the importance of a revolutionary party, at the time this was published, few in the SPD were actually interested in refuting it. And they were basically maintaining the SPD's increasing habit of avoiding open disagreements and leaning towards compromise. Furthermore, most did not see Bernstein's position actually as contradictory to the current ideology of the party. But Luxembourg, and at this point it's funny, Luxembourg was this young newcomer to the German scene, and she saw immediately that Bernstein's arguments represented much more than an update to Marxist politics or Marxist ideas, and actually they represented ideas that were directly in conflict. Her articles were published as two series. The first was in response to his articles, and the second was in response to his book. And although Rosa eventually won the argument against Bernstein, and resolutions against reformism passed at the Congresses of 1899, 1901, and 1903, and at the International Congress of 1904, she not only faced discrimination as a woman and also as a young woman while she was arguing these out, but ultimately, even though the resolutions were passed, it really only masked the continuing dominance of reformism within the SPD. So a little bit about Rosa. She was an extraordinary revolutionary. She was born to a deeply divided and unstable Poland in 1871. And at this time, Poland had been divided by multiple foreign powers undergoing varying political transformations. And this had led to a series of conflicts, upheavals, and consequent harsh repression that sort of create the backdrop for Rosa's youth and education. This repression included the exile of at least 10,000 Polish and also a Russification campaign that restricted Polish language and culture. Poland was also a country of widely variant levels of development. Some regions had been industrialized, while others maintained feudal characteristics. And in fact, her birthplace was indicative of this sort of uneven development, in which the penetration of the monetary system into the district, remote as it was from the industrial centers, had brought really only the hardships that come with the destruction of the feudal order of society, and not really the advantages of the new. As a student, Rosa experienced oppression on several personal levels, as a woman, as Polish, and as Jewish. There were rigid quotas for Jews in the schools, and the Russification program forbade the speaking of Polish. Even as a child, Rosa rebelled against these rules, and she really quickly became part of the hotbed of resistance that was fermenting in the schools. As Paul Froelich explains in her biography, he says, what began as Polish national opposition to the Russianization attempts in the schools often led into the revolutionary socialist movement, whose supporters in those days were almost exclusively the intellectual youth. And although her parents were not revolutionaries, they opposed Tsarism and Russian imperialism, and they basically cultivated a lot of Rosa's intellectual growth. When she was threatened with deportation in 1889, for her political activism, she fled to Zurich, Switzerland, where she continued her education at the university. And it was also basically while she was in Zurich that while she was formally continuing her education, she was also becoming an integral part of the revolutionary circles. And then it was in 1898 that Luxembourg relocated to Germany to be at the center of the international workers' movement. And it was in Germany that she would write her first hugely influential work, Reform or Revolution. All right, so Reform or Revolution. So Luxembourg argued in the pamphlet that Bernstein's arguments in favor of gradual change through reform rather than through revolution centered around two main arguments. One, his belief that the fundamental nature of capitalism was changing in a way that would alleviate its contradictions and avoid its eventual collapse, and two, his belief that trade unions and cooperatives could reform their way to a socialist state. Bernstein supports his assertion that a general decline of capitalism seems improbable for two reasons. Because it seems increasingly capable of adaptation, and because capitalist production is becoming more and more varied. His main argument was that credit, cartels, and trusts were regulating the anarchic nature of the system. Consequently, instead of being prone to intrinsic booms and busts, as visualized in Marx's economic analysis, there would be a tendency towards permanent prosperity. He also argued that social contradictions would be weakened, and there would be more democratic distribution of wealth and a widening of the middle class through the investment of stocks. So he saw really like the birth of the stock market and investment as a way to alleviate some of the contradictions and to spread wealth more democratically around. In addition to this, he argued that a combination of the credit system, employers' organizations, and wider means of communication on one hand, and the tenacity and growth of the middle class on the other, all sort of supported this idea of the adaptability of capitalism. Bernstein's conclusion from this is that the social democracy must consequently place its energy on the amelioration of the daily lives of the workers and not a broader political aim. Bernstein's idea that credit, cartels, and trade unions would ameliorate antagonisms within capitalism were directly in contrast to Marx's argument that crises in the capitalist system would increase with its expansion and development. Marx's analysis depends on the growing crises to force workers to make the move to a more planned economic system. Bernstein's ideas were a rejection of this economic theory, not simple updates to Marxism, as he argued. Luxembourg countered that Bernstein's arguments against the probable decline of capitalism led him to deny other ideas that constituted the fundamental components of socialist theory. The linchpin of workers' struggle holds that the functions of capitalist economy lead inevitably to its ruin, while at the same time providing a social atmosphere for the birth of a future social order and the increased organization and consciousness of the working class. By arguing that capitalism could adapt, he was also arguing that capitalism will not destroy itself, and that instead the antagonisms between capital and labor will be reduced, and there would be no need, basically, to create the germs of a future social order. If struggle is the result of the deepening contradictions, and it is an economic necessity, and this was sort of Marx's main point, that it was an economic necessity, then this necessity would then become irrelevant, right, if the system was adapting or alleviating the contradictions. As Luxembourg explains, Bernstein's argument results in a dilemma. Either the socialist transformation is, as it was admitted up to now, the consequence of internal contradictions of capitalism, resulting inevitably at some point in its collapse, or the means of adaptation really will stop the collapse of the capitalist system and thereby enable capitalism to maintain itself by suppressing its own contradictions. In that case, socialism ceases to be a historic necessity. All right, so Rosa Luxemburg deeply disagreed with Bernstein's position that credit would serve to alleviate the contradictions of capitalism that leads to crises, arguing that credit has two roles under capitalism. One, to extend production and to facilitate exchange by making available to each individual capitalist the use of another capitalist's money. She argued that credit actually worsens the crisis for two reasons. That it influences their formation by provoking overproduction and then destroying, during the crisis, the productive forces it created. And two, by stimulating crises by encouraging the speculative investment of the property of others. Additionally, rather than ameliorating contradictions under capitalism, it actually makes the problems bigger by aggravating the antagonism between the mode of production and the mode of exchange by stretching production to its limits and then paralyzing the exchange, by aggravating the antagonism between the mode of production and the mode of appropriation by separating production from ownership, and by aggravating the antagonism between property relations by putting large resources into a small number of hands. I think it's easy for us in sort of the middle of this economic crisis that we're in, which is certainly, you know, the deepest crisis since the Great Depression and potentially worse. It's easy for us to see that Bernstein was wrong and Rosa Luxemburg was right about the future of crises in capitalism. But I also think that Bernstein based this assertion on the fact that Germany had not seen a crisis for two decades. And I think it's certainly easy to see how in a period of stability it seems impossible that there will be a large crash. It seems like every time it's brand new. Like, oh, we didn't think the system could still completely fall apart. And I think in many ways the current economic state has reminded us of this instability that most denied just a few years ago. So in some ways we're sort of at like a unique position to be looking at Bernstein's theories and Rosa's counters. It wasn't just Alan Greenspan who was marveling at the wonders of the market a few years ago. I mean, it was like basically all top economists who were saying, you know, crises are obsolete, the markets have nowhere to go but up, and clearly that's not true. And I think if anything, this should remind us of the relevance of Luxembourg's argument now, despite or maybe because of the major developments that have occurred over the last decade, like the consolidation of wealth. So let's see. Okay, so first Bernstein's first argument was that capitalism was adapting. And then his second argument now is about the role of trade unions and trade unions and cooperatives within the movement. And so he basically argued that these would, you know, these were part of the reason why gradual change through reform could actually bring the social change necessary. But there are several weaknesses to this argument, including his perception of the role of the parliament and the ruling class, and also the limitations of trade union reforms. Bernstein maintained that led by parliament, the trade unions and the cooperatives would be able to lead the charge gradually towards socialism. But Bernstein's argument presupposes that the state works in the interest of the working class. According to him, parliament was the embodiment of society's will. In other words, it was an above-class institution. Rosa Luxemburg believed the opposite, however, and she argued that the present state is not society representing the rising working class. It is itself the representative of capitalist society. It represents the organization of the ruling class, which in this case was still the bourgeoisie. According to Bernstein, the reforms would be realized with the help of labor unions and cooperatives. He thought that the labor unions would suppress industrial profit by keeping wages fair and working conditions good, and that then cooperatives would do away with commercial profit. As Luxembourg explains, though, the problem with this theory is that in a capitalist economy, production depends to a great extent on market possibilities. And the resulting competition then becomes a survival mechanism of the system. Like, it will do whatever it needs to maintain that. Capital dominates the process of production, shortening or lengthening the workday according to the market, creating more or less employment, and determining any other methods that enable the capitalist to basically beat out its other competitors. Consequently, any workers forming a cooperative have to survive in this system. And they have to govern themselves with the utmost absolutism, which either would lead to their failure by becoming pure capitalist enterprises or end them by dissolving. Luxembourg argued that producers' cooperatives can survive within the capitalist economy only if they manage to suppress the capitalist-controlled contradiction between the mode of production and the mode of exchange, which can be accomplished only by removing themselves from the influence of the laws of competition by assuring themselves of consumers as in a consumer's cooperative. So if they know that they have consumers to give their goods to, then this is the only way that it would work. So consequently, the possibilities of working producer cooperatives are caught up in the limitation of a consumer cooperative in a small local market that services immediate needs like food. The cooperatives would not be able to function in the most important sectors like industrial production. As Luxembourg argues, the establishment of producers' cooperatives on a large scale would suppose, first of all, the suppression of the world market, the breaking up of the present world economy into local spheres of production and exchange. The highly developed, widespread capitalism of our time is expected to fall back to the merchant economy of the Middle Ages. In part, Bernstein came to his conclusion because of the strong position of trade unions at this time, but I think it's important to note that labor legislation that had been enacted up to that point was still within the limitations of what was in line with the interests of the dominant class and what was good for economic development. There were also limitations to the reforms that trade unions could introduce. And I think although the wins that occur within trade unions represent fundamental steps forward for the workers, they're limited to a struggle for an increase of wages and a reduction of labor time, not a fundamental change of the system itself. the system of production itself. As long as the capitalist system of production is intact, workers will be forced to continue to fight for reforms constantly or risk having them peeled away. And this idea forms the basis of Luxembourg's labor of Sisyphus analogy, which basically likens the continual fight for reforms to the stone that Sisyphus was forced to push up the hill over and over. You push it up, it gets rolled back. You push it up, it gets rolled back. And Luxembourg, I think it's really important to say that Luxembourg never denounced reforms or placed them in counterposition to revolution. As her famous passage from Reform or Revolution states, legislative reform and revolution are not different methods to be picked out at pleasure from the counter of history, just as one chooses hot or cold sausages. Instead, the two play different roles in the development of class society. Really, it was Bernstein who first placed the two in contradiction. For Luxembourg and other revolutionary Marxists, reform and revolution were always connected. As Luxembourg explains in the opening section of her articles, the daily struggle for reforms, for the amelioration of the condition of the workers within the framework of the existing social order, and for democratic institutions, offers the social democracy the only means of engaging the proletarian class war and working in the direction of the final goal, the conquest of political power and the suppression of wage labor. In addition, the role of trade union and parliamentary activity are important for the socialist movement because such activity both trains the worker to organize and convinces them through that struggle, through trade union struggle, that fundamental change cannot happen without taking power. For Luxembourg, the final goal, though, was always social transformation, while Bernstein's argument is that we should renounce the final goal and instead make social reforms the aim of the movement. It was this final goal that Luxembourg argued distinguishes socialists from bourgeois radicalism. Luxembourg argued throughout the pamphlet that what Bernstein was promoting was not just another way to reach socialism, but rather a different goal entirely. Instead of taking a stand for the establishment of a new society, they stand for the surface modifications of the old society. Bernstein was actually redefining the role of the labor movement to be a reform party and not a party of social revolution. Rosa Luxemburg's response was fundamental in combating the reformist tendencies in the SPD at the time that it was published, and it remains a fundamental text today to help us understand the relationship between reform and revolution. So, looking at reform and revolution today, I think understanding the key aspects of the debate between Bernstein and Luxembourg can help us to understand or help us to see the legitimacy of the debate today. For over 20 years, we've seen rising healthcare costs, rising economic inequality, the consolidation of wealth into fewer and fewer hands, and the stripping away of civil rights like privacy and abortion. And finally, it feels like there's a fight back. As Luxembourg argued, through these struggles, workers will be convinced to ask for more and to begin to imagine a different world. I think that we can look at the marriage equality movement for an indication that this is still true. 10 years ago, I and others in the gay rights movement never imagined that we would see nationwide gay marriage in our lifetimes. And when Proposition 8 passed in California, many in the movement argued that the state was not ready and that 2010 was too soon to readdress the issue. But I think the recent passage of marriage equality bills in 5 states in the U.S. has had a huge effect on activists in California, and also in other states who are encouraged to ask for more sooner rather than, you know, stand back and wait. And, you know, I think the repeal of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, is legitimately on the table in a way that it hasn't been, you know, basically since it was passed. But, you know, these reforms can be lost as well, and it's vital that we understand the limitations of reforms without fundamental change in our system. We face a lower standard of living than our parents, and this is not because we're less productive. Rather, it's because we have actually lost many of the gains in working conditions won by unions, won by reforms, and won by things fought and won under Roosevelt's New Deal. And this means that we're actually fighting for conditions that have been won before and lost. It's important to look back at the history of struggle and the place that we are in today if we are to understand the best ways not just to regain what we have lost, but to ask for more as well, to actually move forward. And if we are to follow Bernstein's model, we will find ourselves here again, fighting for the same rights won once and lost over time. But if we agree with Rosa Luxemburg and believe that we must fight for reforms at the same time that we recognize that the end goal is a fundamentally reorganized society, we stand a chance of truly winning a different world.
Okay, so we have plenty of time for discussion. Obviously, a lot to discuss, both in terms of the theory and application today and the relationship to struggles today. I'll keep a speakers list. Raise your hand at any time. We have lots of time, so I'm not going to be terribly strict, but if you go beyond 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes, I'll ask you to wrap up after 2.5 minutes. So hold your hands up, I'll note you down, and take speakers as we go. Yeah, go ahead, okay. Kick off.
Hi, I'm Claire from Iowa. I just have a quick question, and if you want to take more questions than I answer them all at once, it's fine. But could you talk a little bit more about bourgeois radicalism? Can you just explain what that is?
Okay. And do, if you have questions, either coming from the talk or if you've had a chance to look at Rosa's essay, get them out early and we'll have full discussion on the floor on that.
Also, I know other people in this room can answer some of these questions probably better than I can, so feel free to join in the discussion.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I was just wondering, like, you said you had a really big following, Edward Bernstein, like, he was like a prominent figure in the late 1800s on the German left and everything. Like, I guess I'm wondering why he would even be that popular, and couldn't people just read Marx and see that he's going against a lot of, you know, basic Marxist principles and ideas? And then also, I was wondering what the relationship between Bernstein and Kautsky was, because I'm not sure if they had the same view. I think it was a little bit different. Like, one's like evolutionary socialism, one's like through parliament. So, and then my third question was, how would the Fabians influence Bernstein? Because he went to England. I mean, did the Fabians have a similar conception of socialism?
Okay, and not everybody may know what everybody else knows in the room, so as even in asking questions, go ahead and, you know, kind of try to explain stuff to the room a little bit. We got a couple of good questions on the floor. Yes, sir.
Do you sort of have any anecdotes in particular that bear on the reaction of figures, leading compromise figures from the SPD, like Kautsky and Bernstein, after the German Reichstag voted for war credits and to what extent did these people recognize that a fantastic betrayal and disaster that was represented by that vote? You know, was there any acknowledgement right away? It was just, you know, horrible. That's the kind of one.
Yeah. And the floor is open. Yeah.
Were these sort of debates, were they carried out sort of with both parties under the same, you know, still in the SPD? Or, you know, was it like sort of official kind of splits and things like that in relation to the debates?
Okay, a lot of questions. Anybody want to...
You guys are making my job really hard up here.
Yeah, in back.
I'll just go for the first question, which is why the popularity of Bernstein. I think that you have to think of it, first of all, in terms of what the German SPD was out of the party, which was a very, you know, a massive institution, you know, that with its, with, I mean, you know, there were some 100 party newspapers, something like that. There were, you know, there were whole there's a major part of not only German society, German economy, and the membership of the German SPD were not all sort of, you know, they were not merely Bolshevik, you know, cadre, you know, steel Marxists in that sense. They were a party that was built primarily through the struggle or what struggles of the working class for the last, you know, few decades preceding. So, you know, I think that the, what Daniela said about the expansion of German capitalism and the boom years is the key reason I understand why no matter, you know, if Bernstein's ideas were connecting with the experience of a whole section of the workers and who had seen rising living standards, who had seen, you know, the expansion of capitalism in that way. And I think that in any period of, you know, sustained prosperity, there's the potential for, you know, people to feel like, you know, or actually just that people feel like there's a possibility of reform through that, you know. And I think that what the debate that came out was partly because of that material reality. And I know that, I don't know the specifics on all those details, but I know that Kautsky stood to the center and was sort of in between Rosa Luxemburg's position and Bernstein's position. He wasn't for revolutionary socialism. But, you know, I think that the key questions that came up, this debate happened, and I think that, importantly, that I think organizationally, it happened, but at the end of the day, the German SPD stayed together as a mass party, and a lot of the actual divisions between the different positions of the revolutionaries and the others were actually suppressed by, you know, the way that the party organized. So actually this all came to a fore much later, obviously, during the German Revolution, when the actual split happened within the German SPD. But a lot of the contradictions organizationally didn't come out as a direct result of this debate, but they really were, it was a clarifying debate, obviously, internationally for the left.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm Justin from San Diego. I'm trying to take on one of the questions. Bourgeois radicalism, I think this is an important thing to dissect a little bit. I would answer that question by breaking it up into categories and historical periods, because I think we can look at bourgeois radicalism like a big business bourgeois radicalism, which really we understand in the context of the transition from pre-capitalist to capitalist societies. For instance, if we look at somebody like a historical figure like Abraham Lincoln, who, you know, was a representation of a rising industrial bourgeoisie in the northern part of the United States at the time, being pushed to adapt more radical methods to remove all the fetters or the remaining fetters on the full development of industrial capitalism. So, for instance, one of the radical Republicans of the day, Thaddeus Stevens, was a senator, right, considered one of the radical Republicans, was actually an industrialist, right? He actually owned boundaries, and he was part of the Underground Railroad. He would help hide slaves in his foundries, and was part of the Underground Railroad. So, in that sense, you know, the bourgeoisie was pushed to take more radical measures. I think the more common form of bourgeois radicalism is we find that there's petty bourgeois radicalism, which is the radicalism of the sort of middle class or the small owner. And I think that this was much more common within the SDP. And this is sort of like, you know, the section of the middle class that wants to sort of redistribute the wealth of the, you know, that's concentrated in the hands of the few, the big bourgeoisie, but to redistribute it along capitalist lines so that they too can have an opportunity to accumulate wealth and rise within their class. So I think that in the general sense, you know, bourgeois radicalism then just refers to people who advocate, you know, change, and it can be very radical change, but typically not anti-capitalist change, but radical change to make capitalism, from their perspective, more effective. And I think one of the ways that we find this in social movements today, even if it's not consciously identified as petty bourgeois radicalism, is the idea that capitalism actually can be reformed, right? There's the potential for a human face. If we just get the right people in power, we can actually make the system work for us. And so that's a kind of continuation of this. And I think the last point is the SDP, as was, you know, very well explained, began to adapt to the idea that we appeal to the broadest sectors of society, and tolerated the growth of a petty bourgeois radicalism within it that began to take shape and the expression and express itself through Edward Bernstein.
Okay, thanks. Floor is open. Yeah,
I would like to start, you know, with the last question. SPD leaders, you know, after the First World War broke out, you know, recognized, you know, the mistakes of their previous ways, and just the quote, you know, by Kautsky, you know, who actually, you know, in the middle of the war, you know, when it started, you know, he actually, you know, I guess, thrown his hands up in the air, said, you know, that the Social Democratic Parties, you know, they are good, you know, for peacetime, good tools, you know, for peacetime, but not good, you know, tools, you know, for wartime. I don't know what exactly, you know, he said, you know, after that, you know, but basically what applies is, you know, that if peacetime, you know, had continued, if the First World War had not happened, then, you know, the ways, you know, things that were moving, you know, the way, you know, the SPD, you know, was actually, you know, working, you know, through the parliament, the way, you know, it had built, you know, this state, empire, you know, inside, you know, capitalist, you know, Germany, that would be fine, that would lead, you know, to eventually, you know, a radical change, you know, socialism and all that. So the reason, you know, for that, you know, where, you know, is that what had happened, you know, in Germany is that SPD, you know, through a long period of legal life, you know, and participating in the elections, you know, and unions and all that, they had built really, you know, a huge machine, a huge, you know, in the sense, you know, that it was employing a huge bureaucracy to run all that. And definitely, you know, all these people, you know, being paid, you know, to do, you know, something different than actually being engaged, you know, in day-to-day, you know, class struggle, organizing, you know, the fight, you know, the struggles for workers, you know, rights and all that, you know, seeing things, you know, in a different way. Now, all that, you know, had to, you know, the beginnings, the way, you know, that party developed, you know, in, you know, what, you know, actually Bernstein, you know, had the initial, you know, vertical beginnings, you know, where, you know, his work, you know, was grounded, you know. And, for example, you know, he considered, you know, historical materialism, you know, to be, you know, fatalistic. That means, you know, that, you know, without really, you know, determinism, without really the, how do you call it, the human agency, without really, you know, the working class, you know, itself, you know, being active, becoming conscious, you know, participating, that, you know, the world, you know, would be led, you know, into socialism. And that wasn't what Marx said. That was what Rosa Luxemburg, you know, tried, you know, to attack, you know, to explain, you know, through this work.
Wrap up,
just one more thing, you know, it was a crucial mistake, you know, is when, you know, consider, you know, the state, you know, to taking over the government as a means, you know, to really change, you know, gradually things, or the trade unions, you know, he neglected, you know, the basic, you know, analysis, Marxist analysis about, you know, capitalism, that, you know, in contrast with previous forms, you know, of exploitation, like, you know, in feudal society, where, you know, by law, society was divided in the states, and the king, you know, and the nobility, whatever, would take just a few seconds.
Yeah.
In contrast to that, you know, capitalist domination rested not, you know, on certain laws, you know, but economic relations, the way, you know, that, you know, production was going on, that they had the means of production, the factors and everything, and the workers, they had to go there, you know, make a living to survive. Okay?
Wrap up.
Sorry.
Thanks. I don't have anyone else, but I don't want to. Yeah, let people. So we've gotten to some of these questions. New questions are very welcome. Also, I expect that any number of us talk to people who basically have a faith in reformability of capitalism. How do those discussions, how does Rosa's analysis help us out on that? Yeah.
I just wanted to maybe get back to the bourgeois radicalism. I mean, is there maybe a distinction between, you know, bourgeois radicals who are working on their interests, and then I guess you could call them reformists who say, like, you know, capitalism, if we can reform it, we can do good for the working class. I mean, would we call them socialist reformists rather than bourgeois radicals?
Okay. Other questions?
I can come back on that a little bit. I mean, I think we call them reformists, but I also think we understand that, like, that's a very natural, like, an understandable thing, that we live in a society in which, like, we are taught that the way that you change, that we're told that we live in a democracy, and the way that you fight to better your life is that you fight for reforms, right? So I think that what we need to do is make sure that we meet people there, and then, you know, like, introduce them to the ideas, but also understand that it's actually through struggle, it's actually through working for reforms, that they will learn themselves that there are limitations to those reforms. And so I think that it's really important that, you know, I mean, as stark as an argument as Rosa Luxemburg makes against reformism in Reform or Revolution, I think it's really important that we understand that, like, mostly when people are fighting for reforms, they are fighting for good reasons. You know, like, they're fighting because they honestly and legitimately want to make the world a better place. And that's a good thing, and that's not something that we should, you know, like, be against. It's our job as historians and as theorists to sort of, like, study history, to look at, like, what brought us to where we are, to look at the historical progression of fighting for reforms, what happens, and then be able to talk about that with them so that we can say, you know, well, actually, you know, this we won during the New Deal, but we've actually lost it now, so that people see sort of, like, the historical struggle of what happens. And so I think that's really, like, the main thing that I kind of think we should take out of this and be able to use today. And it means that we absolutely fight for single-payer healthcare. Absolutely. Even though we recognize that it's a reform, we absolutely fight for the repeal of DOMA. You know, all of these things that will legitimately make people's lives better.
This might be a ridiculous
question. Go ahead.
It strikes me when I'm sort of hearing the last couple of remarks, you know, aimed at around the subject of bourgeois radicalism, that one might think of the civil rights movement in the 60s in this country, where up to a certain point in time, Martin Luther King, right, he was certainly, he had many enemies, but he was accepted as a civil rights leader. When he gave this famous speech at Riverside Church a year before he was killed, he began to make a connection between capitalism as the economic system itself and the plight of poor people. And that sort of put him over a kind of line where that sort of made him unacceptable in certain circles. Whereas other civil rights leaders didn't so much mess around with that line. And, you know, Jesse Jackson is like, he's on the right side of a number of things. He was closely associated with Martin Luther King, but he never really attacked capital. He stayed away from that. So there was kind of a significant difference in behavior there that seems somewhat related to the discussion that was preceded.
Yeah, and I'll actually call on myself, I'll time myself here. So just to kind of come in on that and give some picture of the historical perspective, because absolutely, Martin Luther King moving toward a critique of capitalism on the basis of his fight for basically democratic reforms within the system. The SPD was an anti-capitalist party. It was a socialist party. So you have to kind of, you know, push things even a little farther, that what Luxemburg is locking in on is reformism within self-conscious, the inheritors of Marx. I mean, Bernstein was no, you know, fly on the wall or anything. He was in close relationship with Engels. He was one of the inheritors of the legacy of Marxism. But there hadn't been the Russian Revolution yet. There hadn't been state in revolution, a kind of clear theorization of the Marxist theory of the state, for instance. So these were live and very practical debates. So I think that's, you know, one thing that helps set the context for us, that when Rosa talks about the aim of the movement, she, as Daniela pointed out, she talked about the conquest of political power and the suppression of the wages system. That's pretty big, right? But within the SPD, people had all kinds of different pictures about what that looked like. That was a shared goal, but how to get there was in a lot of ways the main thing. So, you know, when we talk about bourgeois radicalism, I think we're starting with a working class organization in the SPD. We're starting with a body of Marxism as it's kind of evolving historically. So, you know, I think the sharpness that Rosa brings to the question of whether capitalism can be reformed or not, can capitalism deliver for humanity or not, is really important for us today as a starting place in the discussion. And in back.
Yeah, I just wanted to come back and say that it's important to place this discussion in a historical context, mm-hmm. because I think what Bruce and other people have made reference to is that this is in a time when we have a rising workers' movement, we have, you know, the concept of winning reforms actually was based on the idea that we had to struggle for it, even if we no longer believe in the revolution. And I think it ushered in, like in the United States, for instance, we have this tradition becoming sort of institutionalized, this concept of reformism, mm-hmm. right, which is a sort of a very dominant trend within the left, which actually has moved far away from even the idea that we have to struggle for things, because now mm-hmm. we have a place at the table, you know, vis-a-vis the Democratic Party. And this is a legacy of Bernsteinism, right? But it's not the legacy of a strong workers' movement, right? That we didn't have an SDP type of formation here in this country. We had a workers' movement, but that helped give, win to the sale of reformism. But the Democratic Party itself was never based on this idea that we have to sort of fuse struggle, fighting for reforms. And so I think what we have today is this concept of reformism without the struggle, right? And we find this, it's a major trend within the social movements that we work in, and it's a contradictory trend, right? Because people are pushed to struggle because they see that we have to go beyond the Democratic Party, but at the same time, they see the struggle then feeding into and dovetailing into this idea that we can use this to influence the Democratic Party. And we see this is being discredited again and again. And I think that's where we meet the people who actually, that made reference to, the people who actually want real reform are going to be drawn into these types of movements because our ideas aren't powerful enough, or we're not big enough to really counterpose our ideas to reformism, but we can unite our ideas with people who actually want real reform. And oftentimes, and most of the time, that's going to be, in contradiction to the leadership of the organizations on the ground, who, as an expression of their reformism, are actually hostile, right, to class struggle, and try to marginalize that within the movement.
I really want to encourage people who haven't spoken yet to join in. Yes, sir.
Well, I wonder if one could focus on the inadequacy of Rosa Luxemburg in her final phase as unable really to go beyond the conception, which one might take from Marx, that it isn't a question of what this worker or that worker wants to do, but it's a question of the working class. As such, will be compelled to be. Well, all right, but what about the leadership? And did Luxemburg ever focus on the role of leadership adequately? We think of all the Mensheviks with really very, very left positions, like Yuli Markov. There was nothing wrong with what they say. They're right out there as flaming revolutionaries. The problem is, we think of Luxemburg finally with Liebknecht. Liebknecht followed the impulse of the workers. Rosa was left to say, is that our program? That is, he completely abandoned the program of Spartacus in order to give a temporary leadership. But there wasn't the kind of leadership that had been constructed the way Lenin had. So that there they were, left-hanging, and of course, for Lenin, Rosa is an eagle, but along with saying that she's an eagle, you have to look at all of what she did, which wasn't building a leadership with authority that could say, worker, You now have to go on a flying picket squad to defend the Puchima workers. But a party that doesn't have that authority can't fight adequately and can have all the good ideas of the Yulimarta, but it can't bring them to life. Okay.
Thanks. Feel like coffee's getting into everybody's bloodstream here.
I just feel like fussing out. This is something responsible to use that when you asked about why it wasn't recognized what Bernstein was saying, which is not Marxist at all. When you look at different historical examples of the UK or the UK, there's like numerous examples of where you could see from a distant perspective that they went off the track somewhere, like in Britain, the Labour Party was once supposed to be really an older working man's party, and the SPD in Germany, and then, you know, after the New Deal, Democrats in this country were supposed to be for the little guy, and you look 50 years later, and it's very easy to see, they just like aren't like that at all anymore. But at the time, it wasn't obvious, you know, at what point in time would you say the Democrats would be completely like sold out? It wasn't obvious. There's some kind of historical parallel between all those situations. And it was probably, you know, it was doubtless easier for Bernstein speaking in a prosperous and seemingly peaceful period to make these accommodations that are the first step towards selling out, which only becomes obvious later.
Mm-hmm. Can you comment on that?
Sure.
I absolutely agree with that, and I also think I think there's a reason why, like I said, that we're sort of at a unique position to sort of look at capitalism's development and denounce, you know, some of the arguments that Bernstein was making. But I think certainly, you know, in the incipient stage that capitalism was at when Rosa Luxemburg was writing, like, it would be easy to sort of try to think, like, oh, maybe it will go a different way. Maybe it could, you know. And I think, I think to go along with that, there's also, like, sort of yesterday Paul D'Amato was saying that it was, like, sort of the hugeness, actually, of the SPD and, like, the things that they were able to achieve in the Reichstag that actually led to its demise. And I think it opens up the space for, like, you know, by their program of wanting to be able to reach, like, the most amount of people and get the most amount of votes, that they started to really, like, deny some of their Marxist roots. And I think that that's something that's, like, sort of understandable, even though, like, it's absolutely amazing that Rosa Luxemburg, like, formulated actually like an economic theory and was able to pull out those arguments and say, like, actually Bernstein isn't just saying that Marxism needs to be updated. He's actually saying that, like, what he's actually saying is actually directly in contradiction to how we understand Marx's economic theories. And I think that it's actually pretty incredible that we can look back at Rosa Luxemburg's work and see to the extent to which she economically broke down his arguments and argued that he was actually getting rid of the historical necessity for socialism, or basically saying that that historical necessity was no longer true.
Okay, I have you. Let me see if other folks want to jump in. Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Speak to the room, if you would.
Oh, sure. Well, I just think it's interesting what Daniela just said, because it sounds like, and I haven't read Bernstein, but it sounds like he was saying pretty much the same things that people, using the same arguments that people today use to defend capitalism and the credit system. Mm-hmm. Kind of this force will just eventually work itself out, and we'll have boom years and bust years, but the system is good. We just have to wait for it, kind of, you know? And it was really working at the time, just like it seemed to be really working sometimes in our lifetime and in history too. So yeah, I think that's very interesting.
Good. We're kind of getting to the economic discussion about reform versus revolution. Hopefully people can pick up pieces of that so that, you know, people share in the room about the Marxist analysis of that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think the discussion of, electives, I mean, that seems almost like a semi-syndicalist position that you think. It seems almost like Bernstein is taking not only, reforms with labor unions and reforms using the state, but also, a position of, collectivist. It seems almost like an anarchist idea.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'll just throw this in. I'm trying to make up for the holes in my knowledge from this Western Marxist tradition. But I always tell young Chinese who were born after Cultural Revolution years that Marx was a German living in England, London, during the Industrial Revolution and child labor. So I just wanted to bring the European, German, and Russian experience up to date now with Asia, China, and the fact that when the U.S. won the Second World War and colonized basically Japan and other, states like South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and then in Europe now, my understanding of what's holding back the German progressive and working class and those in Poland were trying to, maintain their worker rights is the U.S. military, because we've left this, my German-American friend says that, the U.S. runs its military empire with the bases in Germany. They can't operate the Middle East, Europe, NATO. They're doing AFRICOM out of Stuttgart, Germany. And so that's the German peace movement's frustration, is the hold of the U.S. military there. And I'm sure the Polish people have been out demonstrating against the missile defense, but that seems to be a big struggle. The Czech Republic has actually had a victory of sorts. With their, is it the Humanist Party now in Czech Republic? Well, I'm just trying to get my hands around the part, the Marxist history that I didn't learn when I studied Marxism, Leninism, Mao Zedong thought. But I do know that since the bulk of the a lot of the global economy and military is moving into the West Pacific and Asia, Japan is having a phenomenal increase in their Communist Party membership. But we don't hear about this.
Wrap up,
things.
Please.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Introduce yourself.
Kind of late, so I hope I'm not repeating what's already been said. But in terms of why is Bernstein believed, why wasn't what he said recognized as not Marxist, and why did he have the following that he had, and so forth? We have to remember that before the First World War, that it wasn't only a matter of parties breaking down, as you said. But the German working class was the envy of the world, say the start of 1914. It was not what it was in 1918, where you had the possibility of the working class revolution. And so in that situation, workers are much less likely to be revolutionary Marxists. So he had that broad audience to speak to. And then also, I think one of the real dangers of what Bernstein was setting forth was he was saying, okay, let's take everything gradually. Let's work everything through Parliament, which means we'll present ideas to Parliament, and they'll give us gradual reforms until we finally have socialism, if indeed we need it at all. What that does, it stops the struggle of workers. It's saying this is going to be an arena of ideas, not of struggle. You know, we're going to go to Parliament and so forth. And once you stop, tell workers they don't need to struggle anymore, then you really have the end of real progress.
We got a few more minutes, so I want to make sure that people who haven't spoken get a chance to. So if you have any questions and any last questions, we can get on the floor.
I mean, just going back to, you know, why Bernstein was why he was accepted, and, you know, why he had popularity and all this sway. I mean, I think your answer was really good, and what you guys were saying, that, you know, the material conditions at that time, I mean, that's the way I would look at it. I mean, I don't know enough, but that's what makes sense to me. If I were living in Germany in the late 1800s, I probably would have been, you know, into the German Social Democratic Party. I mean, you know, millions of people or whatever, hundreds of publications, you know, all these cultural institutions, it probably would have been amazing. So I think it makes sense, given the conditions there, you know, non-revolutionary situation, the rise of these trade unions and mass parties, probably been really exciting. But I have a question on just going back to the economic element of the debate. So what, I don't really understand why, like, the rise of massive firms and trusts and cartels, so the claim is that they would regulate production more, like they would collude together. But, I mean, that's, even if you have massive firms, they're still competing, so I don't understand. I mean, the competition is fierce, you know, we have all the major industries in the world are basically all monopolized, really. And, you know, they at least haven't seen overproduction go away. I mean, if anything, I think the competition has gotten more fierce. And I don't also, like, why would credit, I don't understand why credit would stabilize things. I mean, I feel like I understand what our position would be if, like, it exacerbates overproduction. And then once that surfaces, you know, then people pull back, like, there's the credit rationing, right? Like what we're seeing now, which exacerbates the downturn. So it kind of, you know, extends the booms and makes the downturns worse. So what, I don't understand what Bernstein's position was.
Okay, good question. Any other questions, or? Mihar, in back?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the some of the things that, well, one thing about this debate too that both mentioned was just that, like, universal suffrage for workers was not, you know, hadn't been around forever, you know, in general. So not like that whole question of reform and the whole question of what that would do to the worker struggle was actually something that was still alive, like we said very well. But on the economics question, I think that I think that the basic idea was prefiguring some forms of Keynesianism that were to come later, the idea that sort of borrowing and credit could smooth out a business cycle that, you know, that and basically have a role in stemming the tide of production. I mean, I think that that in addition to, I think there was a tendency to say that the consolidation of capital was, you know, was a certain extent creating the conditions where maybe businesses would not be as susceptible to the immediate booms and slumps, and basically overproduction wouldn't have to be able to regulate things. So you're right that, you know, obviously there still is production on a mass scale, and it, in a lot of ways, the development of that, you know, became the debate between Trotsky and Lenin on imperialism, where it was like, if you, you know, which was came later, but it was like, well, you know, that was all about monopoly capitalism, which emerged later on, as you were, the consolidation of capital led to something which Trotsky thought would be the suppression of natural antagonisms and commercial competition, but in fact, one argued that it would fight back and increase those things. And I think that that's exactly what Rose Blocks were saying in some ways about credit and cartels and the consolidation of capital in an earlier phase. And, you know, in terms of the crisis, it's so clear that, you know, in this current crisis, that the massive credit system has tied everything together in such a way that, you know, that these things go away. But it's still true, I think, that these are debates that aren't nearly settled. We can't consider this something for us today. Like, this is something, like Bruce pointed out, that came out of a massive, developed, and more and conscious workers' movement that accepted, you know, anti-capitalism and the idea of transforming society. And that's something, these are prefiguring debates that I think any movement that wants to change capitalism wants to take on in the future at a much higher level. Like, we argue today about reform or revolution, but I think that, you know, I think that the idea of this kind of debate about what is the actual ability of capitalism in today's day and age, because people will come back and argue that there are new things about capitalism today. Mm-hmm. They always have throughout history. I think that today people will say all kinds of things about what the Federal Reserve or whatever can stop us from an alternate crisis in the same kind of way. And we have to actually combat that and look at how fundamentally these same things lead to an exacerbation of the contradictions, the more deep in crisis and more global crisis.
Wrap up. Thanks. Last comments or questions before I throw it back to Daniela?
Yeah. Just throw a quick question out there. I commented in earlier, but I'm just wondering about the kind of the strategies of the NPA, the Anti-Capitalist Party that recently formed. I think it was like all the. It's a really broad party that formed in France, I think it was, of all different groups that, you know, basically had an anti-capitalist position. And so I'm just wondering if anybody has any knowledge of the histories of those parties and what that looks like now, how they're actually organizing and collaborating now, and what sort of strategies they're implementing, and what sort of, you know, on this topic of reform or revolution, how their ideas are either, you know, kind of clashing or if they're actually like melding into something that's really progressive.
Okay, good.
I don't pretend to be an expert on that subject, but I think that there are a lot more like Bernstein than like Rosa Luxemburg, you know, sort of heavily leaning towards reformist and shying away from anything that's Marxist. And I think that the World Socialist website has a very good analysis of them. It's you know that website?
Okay, yeah.
Any other last comments, questions? I'll just throw out one other thought about kind of where the grip or the strength of Bernstein's arguments came out, which I think is important for us in thinking about Marxism and how it applies today. There can be a tendency with Marx to read that everything's going to be automatic, that capitalism is kind of on an inevitable downward trajectory towards its own collapse. And, you know, not that Marx wrote that way or that Engels did either, but in terms of the popularizing of those ideas in the late 19th century, you know, there could be, even within a socialist party, the sort of picture that capitalism is an inevitable decline, that people just get poorer and poorer and that's it. And what would be called a sort of fatalistic, as Daniela mentioned, a kind of history is going to happen no matter what people do. And Bernstein kind of turns that on its head with the experience of an expanding economy over 30 years, and instead, you know, sees a kind of, well, it's not happening that way, so it must be something different, and we have to update Marx. And so that kind of picture, starting with a misunderstanding of how history happens, how capitalism and crisis happens within Marxism, you know, can propel people to support an idea that actually completely breaks with the ideas of Marxism. Yeah.
I just have a question about that. Then I don't understand how anyone could argue that there's not a fatalistic element to Marx's writing, especially the earlier stuff. I mean, to me, it sounds like, yes, it is inevitable. It doesn't mean that we're on a straight decline. it will fix itself. We can limp slowly toward the decline, but this is a destructive, catabolic system, and it will destroy itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is inevitable. I mean, I've just reviewed it to be here, you know. So I mean, I just read this, and it's like, it's fatalistic. I mean, to me, there's almost an apocalyptic element, and I mean, like in the religious sense, I mean, it's atheist, but it's like, this is determined, like this is predetermined, and like the scientific analysis of the system
points in that direction.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. So.
Okay, good. We have a couple of hands, so, and we do have some more time. So go ahead.
I wanted to address that. I don't think that. I mean, a lot of the Second International's Marxism, like the Marxism of the SPD, was really schematic, and they adopted that view that. That socialism was inevitable, but I don't think that Marx ever argued that it was inevitable in the sense that it was going to just happen eventually, no matter what. I mean, capitalism has to be overthrown. Capitalism won't kill itself. I mean, capitalism has had tremendous crises that have, I mean, there's the crisis of the 30s, which led to the Second World War and the atomic bomb, and like brought humanity practically to the brink of destruction, and the Holocaust and all of that. But capitalism is going to have to be overthrown by conscious revolutionaries. And so that, I think, that's what I'll say to that. I mean, the socialism's inevitability only comes from the idea that capitalism will either lead to ruin, which it does, or we're going to have to create something better. So it's inevitable in that sense, but it's not just going to happen on its own.
That's all I was saying. Not that socialism is inevitable, it will happen naturally, but that capitalism will destroy itself.
But it also bounces back, though, with, like, you know, after World War II, there was an unprecedented, like, four decades long protracted growth global capitalism that far surpassed anything that happened before it. So, maybe somebody else can.
Okay. Yeah, I have a couple of hands and we got time, so if anybody wants to jump in on this or any last thoughts, do so now. Yeah.
The way I understand the question of inevitability of socialism in the age of decline of capitalism, and at least the way that I understood the concept of Marx at Machadino, was the very fact that, according to Marx, the forces of production, they will be at a certain point in development of capitalism, they will be a stop from any further development. At that point, these forces will turn into, I mean, if they are not liberated through the conscious intervention of human beings, through emancipation of the whole society, these forces of production will turn into the forces of destruction. And what we see today, of course, with the widespread existence of the nuclear bomb, with the fact that America's army, military, is the biggest on earth, and the fact that we have all these kind of calamities in the world, including the environmental degradation, it shows exactly that aspect of that, that the forces of production have turned into the forces of destruction. And it's bringing the existence of mankind to the brink of extinction, unless some active intervention will take place.
Thank you. George will be our last speaker, and then I'll turn it back to Daniel.
Yeah, I think it's fitting to use
Rosa Luxemburg, you know, fought there, you know, that socialism or barbarism, that eventually either, you know, we will be able to, through struggle, you know, and all that, you know, that they never mentioned her speech, you know, achieve socialism, or the system itself, you know, through the way Marx analyzed, you know, why crises are inevitable, you know, in the process of capitalist expansion, you know, would drive that. So these are things, you know, that going back, you know, into the talk and what Bernstein said, you know, where, you know, his fundamental mistakes were, you know, when he used, you know, these ideas, the means, you know, that had developed at the time of cartels, credit and all that, to show, you know, how actually, you know, capitalism could adjust, you know, adapt, you know, to new circumstances, so, you know, doesn't, you know, lead to this catastrophic, you know, crisis, that they were, you know, simply, you know, mistaken. That first of all, you know, capitalism, you know, and all this, you know, expansion of capitalism, you know, means that, you know, capitalism can't expand forever. Mm-hmm. We see that today, that we have, you know, capitalism in every corner of the world, where credit and the banks, you know, and what they call finance capital has taken over all aspects, you know, of production and control, you know, all of it. That what leads to, what exactly, you know, Luxembourg said there, that the more credit is widespread and controlling the process of production, the more, you know, this, its role, you know, is going to be more catastrophic. We see today, when the banks have frozen up, they get all that money, you know, from governments, and despite, you know, distributing that money, playing the role that they wish they could play, you know, regulate again the economy and all that. No, they obey to the principal rules of capitalism, which say, you know, each one for himself, herself, or whatever corporations call themselves. So, and that's what it is. So, and another fundamental mistake that Bernstein was making there is calling, you know, for, as I said earlier, that historical materialism is a, like, you know, some predetermined that's going to go there, you know, without, you know, realizing the role, you know, that the connection between Luxembourg says, you know, the struggle for reforms and eventually the human agency, the working class becoming conscious, you know, of its role, what can achieve, you know, how we can transform the world, you know, how we can lead socialism. He doesn't see that, okay? And this is, you know, what exactly, you know, the contribution of Luxembourg is, you know, in this book. Once, on one hand, you know, is, you know, the critique, you know, on the fundamental mistakes of the economic theories of Bernstein. The other is, you know, to show that actually, you know, it is, there isn't a contradiction between reform and revolution, rather, you know, it is a relationship between the two.
Yeah. Good. Okay, before Daniela is wraps up, let me just run through the announcements. Haymarket Bookstore is going to be open again at two locations today, at the auditorium downstairs and at the CAP location over on 16th Street. If you'd like to become a member of the International Socialism or learn what it means to join, we have a special session running today, Introduction to the ISO at Lunch. Bring your lunch and meet at 110 Cap Street down across Mission and 16th. Check your Socialism 2009 schedule to see where your next meeting is located. It takes about 10 minutes to walk down to the other building. And please make sure you show and wear your ID for all sessions today. Thanks.
All right. I'll be brief since I think that a lot of the discussion on the floor was great. I think I got to a lot of the key questions that came out. I think one final thing to say sort of in response to, you know, the inevitability of, you know, the self-destruction of capitalism or not is I think in a lot of ways Rosa Luxemburg, it's become more extreme than Rosa Luxemburg's, like, socialism or barbarism. I think it's actually at the point where it's, like, socialism or world destruction, you know, because that is clearly the direction that we're headed. But I also think that part of that, the big part of it, was that Marx actually had a belief in humanity fighting back. He believed that people would fight for a better world. And I think that that's really, like, socialism is not inevitable, but belief in humankind wanting something better than this, I think, is something that's really important. And it's, like, a very ideal and romantic thing, but it's also something that I think that most of us who are drawn to conferences like this we do have that belief that like we can fight for something that's better than this, and that that thing is worth fighting for. And I think that's just an important thing sort of to say. I think it's also really important what Nihar said about like the historical context of, you know, that what was going on with the trade unions, the strength that they had, and the ability actually to have that debate. And I actually hope that someday we get to have that debate. I hope that the trade unions are so strong and workers' struggle is so strong that there actually becomes a debate as to like, oh, you know, like we have so much power, can we actually reform our way to socialism? And that's actually a really exciting thought, and I think that we need to just keep that in mind when we think about it. I hope that that's not the side that wins out, but I hope we actually get to have that debate and fight that actually, like, socialism is our end goal, not reforms to socialism. All right? Thanks.